Thanks for tuning in. Host Noah Weil is a licensed attorney admitted to practice in Washington State and the Federal Court of the Western District of Washington. Some guests on this program may be licensed attorneys as well. However, the discussion on this podcast is intended to be informative only and is not a substitute for legal advice for your particular situation. The information may be right or may be wrong. Changing laws and the laws of individual states mean the information presented here may not be accurate. But regardless, and this part is important, neither Noah nor any guest here is your lawyer. If you need a lawyer for your individual situation, you should consult and retain your own attorney.
Welcome back to the Better Know a Lawyer podcast. This is Noah Weil, and today I'm joined by guest David Greenspan.
Good to be here, Noah.
Hey, David. David is an attorney in Seattle. He has a criminal defense practice as well, but he's also done some other interesting things, which I'm going to talk to him about. But David, to start off with, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been in practice, what you've done as an attorney?
From when I first started working as a prosecuting attorney in Clallam County seems to make the most sense. But just to put it in context, I grew up in the Seattle area, but I ended up going to law school in Ohio. I actually got my law degree from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. But I knew I wanted to practice in Washington, so I came back, took the bar here, and started working in 2007. My first job in Clallam County, I spent a little more than a year out there doing misdemeanors at first, splitting my time between Port Angeles and Forks, which at the height of the Twilight craze was interesting for the folks back home.
How many crimes did you prosecute that were specifically related to Twilight activities?
To be honest, none. But every time I came home, everybody asked me, were there any vampires in Forks this week?
All right. Now, if I remember right, the people in Forks, half of them hated the books, probably because of terrible writing, you know, terrible messages, but the other half kind of cashed in, right? They had shops and stands based around tourists coming to the town.
Absolutely. And in my experience out there, I did actually have the opportunity to talk to a few of the local residents about this, and you're right on the money. It was a pretty even split. The people who were much more religious, much more in the sort of education sector of the community, had mixed feelings. A lot of them didn't like the undertones of the books, but a lot of the shop owners, a lot of the clerks in the court, a lot of the people that owned property in and around the city were actually quite thrilled because it did bring them more economic prosperity that they'd seen in years.
Do you think that Stephanie Myers knew that she'd be blessing the town of Forks? Did she think, I am creating a solid piece of gold in my hands, and I'm going to bestow it upon this tiny town with an immigration problem in rural Washington? Or I'm just writing some garbage to myself, for myself, and who cares what town it is? It could be Atlantis. No one's going to read this or touch it or base anything off of it.
I suspect it's a combination of the two. I think when she wrote it, she really truly believed that what she was writing was going to be the next great American novel. I don't think that she ever gave much thought about the economic consequences that it would bring to the town of Forks. But frankly, I think they've benefited more than they've lost from the introduction of both the books and the movies.
First of all, do you think that Stephanie Myers, thinking that she was writing the next great American novel, and this is a question for a prosecutor, is an indictment to her or the American people?
You know, I'd say it's both. In a sense, she was clearly delusional when she wrote the books, and I don't want to get into the propaganda side of things and all of the nonsense that she writes that is misogynistic.
Well, it's okay, David. You're allowed to have an opinion because you're a male. That's the message I received. You're permitted to think.
That's fair, but frankly, I want to think as little about Twilight as possible.
So you did some small town prosecution work. It was not Twilight based, I believe, although I think you're holding some stories back. But what was the most common charge in the small county, Calum County, which is a really small place, right?
It's a pretty small place, and we're talking about a population of 1/10 of the entire city of Seattle in a single county that covers several hundred square miles. I think Port Angeles, there were maybe about 35,000 to 40,000 people living there when I was there, and then Sequim next door was the other big town, if you can call it that. It's really more like a retirement community out there. A lot of people go out there to have their retirement homes, and it's a beautiful community. I don't blame them. But the other thing about Clallam County that, unless you've actually been there, most people don't know this about it, is that there's really only one highway in the county, and that's Highway 101. And so with only one main road going through the entire east-west length of the county, and a lot of, shall we say, drinking establishments and casinos along the way, the most common offense that I personally ever handled out there was probably driving under the influence. And in fact, that was kind of my big break, if you want to call it that, as a prosecutor in Clallam County. Back in January of 2008, we got our very first felony DUI case. And back then, I was still working in district court, so my responsibility was really just to handle misdemeanor cases.
So I'm talking about yourself. We can do this all the time. But just for the listeners who are not lawyers, what makes a DUI ascend to a felony status?
So there's two ways that you can do it, and this has only been on the books since about July of 2007. It's a relatively recent change to the law. To get a felony DUI, one of two preconditions must exist. Either you've had a prior felony vehicular assault or vehicular homicide on your record, in which case all future DUIs automatically become felony, or you need four or more misdemeanor DUIs within a 10-year period. This particular individual in January of 2008 had his fifth DUI in 6 years. And as soon as I spotted that, I immediately took it to my boss, asked her to refile it in Superior Court, and made the false assumption that it would get assigned to one of the other DPAs. Unfortunately, because there were no other DPAs in my office that had ever handled a DUI within the past 5 years, the responsibility for prosecuting that case ultimately fell back on me. And what I didn't know at the time, but later found out, is that it became the first ever felony DUI case in the state of Washington to be tried before a jury.
That's exciting.
Well, even more exciting, it was taken up on appeal, affirmed on appeal, and ultimately became case law.
So you found a conviction, weren't able to make a deal, he wasn't able to come up with some resolution that was satisfactory, right?
He was maxed out. My boss didn't want to make a deal at all. She took away any discretion that I had to make any deals, basically said, you're taking this one to trial. And his defense attorney, who I know very well, still good friends with, his position was, we have nothing to lose by taking this to trial. So really, it was the perfect combination of circumstances where neither side had any incentive to negotiate. And we ended up going to trial on it. It was a relatively straightforward trial, not very different from any standard DUI trial. The only difference is that we had 12 jurors instead of six.
So you got a big win, and everybody was happy about that, at least on the prosecution side. How long more did you stay? How long were you in that county as a prosecutor?
So altogether, I was there for about 13 months. This case happened in January of 2008, and I left in December of 2008. In that time, I think I ended up doing about two dozen trials altogether between misdemeanor and felony cases, but ultimately ended up leaving and coming back to King County to start my defense practice.
When you were in Calum County, were you also the coroner?
I was. That was one of the funny things about working in Clallam County is because we were a small county with very little money, we didn't have a proper medical examiner's office. And so it fell on the prosecutor's office to make determinations about post-mortem investigations. So every deputy prosecutor in the county was issued a deputy coroner card, and we took shifts about a month at a time where we would have to be on call 24/7 to take any calls from the sheriff's office or from the local emergency response services to make a determination about whether or not an unnatural death required further investigation. Most of the time it really didn't, but there were a couple of times when I actually had to go out to a scene to investigate a body with the zero medical experience that I actually have and make a determination as to whether or not a homicide investigation was appropriate.
What was the weirdest cause of death you encountered or at least heard about in your office?
The weirdest cause of death? I think somebody fell off a bridge at one point. I was not on call during that particular shift. I think one of my colleagues took that one.
Were you issued a county certified stick to poke the body and determine? That's all I know about corpse work is poking and sticks.
Yeah, we didn't get sticks, but we did have badges. So
Do you still have your badge?
No, I had to turn it back in when I left that job. I do still have my coroner's card, though, and I do have my coroner's sticker still on the window of my car because I can't really take it off.
There's literally no instance in my day-to-day life where I would not find a reason to show somebody a coroner's badge if I had one. I cannot imagine a day that would go by. If I was at home, if I was handcuffed to the bed, I would find a way to show it to my captors so they knew that they had captured a coroner, and I would feel great about that.
You know, I have shown it off to a lot of people, and I always get the same questions. Where did you go to medical school? Did you have training for that? No, we had no training at all. Basically, we were given a county issue card and said, when the sheriff's deputies call you, you listen to what they have to say, you ask the following questions, and then you make a judgment call as to whether or not to have the body shipped back to King County in order to have a proper medical examiner do a full autopsy.
Okay, so you left the sticks. And going from Ohio to Clallam County is kind of a lateral move, isn't it? It's basically the same education and meth use, is that right?
Yeah, when we're talking about Cleveland, I'd say it's pretty lateral or even a step up in some ways. I mean, at least in Port Angeles, you have some really beautiful scenery, and the water doesn't smell like sewage all the time.
So you come back to King County, the seat of civilization, and you open your own practice, and that's fine. We all know about opening criminal defense practices. But you have another gig that I find interesting, and we've talked about before, and kind of the reason why I wanted you on the show, except for that reason, plus 10 minutes after I published my first episode, you messaged me and said, please let me be on the show. Please, I'll do anything.
I won't deny it.
Please. So here you are. And, begging works, obviously. But the gig you have that I find interesting is that you are full-time private practice, but you also pro tem as a judge.
That's correct. Yeah.
And so I'm going to start off by saying a pro tem is a non-elected judge. It's a temporary judge when the elected judge can't fulfill their duties because they're sick or because there's a conflict of interest or there's a training or something that day, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so they call in a pro tem and you go down to Olympia, right? Thurston County?
Among other places. And I'll just add in there because it is relevant to my personal experience as a pro tem. When they're desperate to fill in a spot, sometimes you get lucky and you draw that straw. But I actually started pro temming in Kirkland Municipal Court just about 3 years ago. And shortly after that, I went down to Olympia just kind of on a fluke. And I have a really good friend who has been working as a public defender down there for the last few years. And she mentioned something to me about how they were needing to get more people down there as pro tems. So I just happened to be in the area, went in, talked with their chief legal assistant.
Wait. You drove down to Olympia, and then once you were in Olympia, you happened to be in the area. That's what I'm hearing here. You took an hour and a half trip from Seattle to Olympia, and then you were like, oh, I'm in Olympia. Well, as long as I'm down here, I'll go talk to the people in charge who make this decision.
That is actually how it happened. I was initially in Olympia with my partner, Kira, who was there for something at the state capitol. It was a legislative thing, a rally for immigrants or immigration reform or something like that.
Hey, David, this is weird, but we're in a room with a recording device and we're recording a podcast. As long as we're here, let's just record a podcast. Just as long as we're here, just like randomly in this room right now.
Sure.
Okay.
Just so that you are aware, the district and superior court for Thurston County isn't in the same location as where the Capitol building is. So if you go to where the Capitol building is, right across the street is the Temple of Justice, which is where the Supreme Court sits. The district and superior court are in a completely separate building about 5 miles away. So we had gone down to the Capitol building for this rally or whatever it was. And as we were getting ready to leave, I actually turned to Kira and I said, hey, since we're down here, do you mind taking a little side trip over to the courthouse? Because I want to see what the pro tem situation is over there. And she was fine with that. So I went in and asked her.
Did you strike out at the Temple of Justice first?
I did. You know, I asked them if they needed some new pro tems there, and they were just like, we'll call you.
No, it does happen, actually. They have had pro tems on the Supreme Court writing opinions, usually when there's a conflict of interest.
Absolutely.
It's pretty rare, and they usually get pretty high pedigreed lawyers to fill in those roles. But
former Supreme Court justices from time to time.
Yeah, it does occur. It does occur.
It does. But no, I went over to the Thurston County District Court, and I asked to speak with the head legal assistant there, and she had me fill out an application form. And as I was filling out the application form, Judge Buckley, who is the chief presiding judge for District Court down there, happened to walk into the room as I was signing my name on the application form, and he picked it up and he looked it over, asked me a couple of questions, and when I told him that I was already working as a pro tem in Kirkland Municipal Court, I believe his response was something to the effect of, oh, you pro tem for Mike Lambeau? Yeah, you must be all right. And he signed the approval right there in front of me. So that was a bonus. And then a couple months after that, that's when I got the call from Mason County. As I said, desperation can be a very, very powerful tool in this arena. They had a situation where their elected was unavailable and their other two regular pro tems were both indisposed for one reason or another. And because I just love driving so much, I agreed to come down there to Mason County with a 2-hour drive from Seattle, and been going there ever since. Apparently the clerks there really, really like me.
Okay. So when you are pro teming, you are a judge. You're standing in the shoes of the judge and the robes of the judge, and you have all the powers and responsibilities a normal judge has, right?
For the most part, yes. There are certain things that I can't do, like I can't sign search warrants, for example. But I can make decisions on any civil or criminal matter that is within the jurisdiction of the district court.
Can you perform weddings?
No, I don't have that power.
Can you do name changes?
I can. I have done a few name changes, actually, in a couple different counties.
Okay. So you have most of the powers. Philosophically speaking, I know you're not a full-time judge. You probably haven't developed a judicial philosophy, quote-unquote. But when you're up there, are you thinking about the sitting judge who you're replacing? Are you trying to enact rulings that they would be doing if they were there? Or are you trying to do your own thing independently?
Primarily, I act on my own independent judgment. And to be honest, when I started doing the pro tem work, every single judge that I have pro temed for says the same thing. Make your own decisions. Don't make your decisions based on what you think I would do or any other judge would do. Especially when you're at the district court level, because the consequences are generally pretty minimal, most of the elected judges don't really care what pro tems do as long as it's consistent with judicial ethics and it follows the law. And when you are a pro tem, every time you go in, I mean, not every single time, but every court that you pro tem for, before you can even take the bench, you have to sign an oath of office. So you're not just some schlub who's being put on the bench to replace a judge, having not been elected and essentially having no accountability. You have to uphold that oath. And it's really, really important that you make a clear record as a pro tem so that when the elected judge does come back, there's no conflicts there. But on that same point, especially Judge Buckley, who's very, very good about running regular trainings for his pro tems, his basic philosophy is don't make any huge, wide-reaching decisions, you know, like declaring that DUI laws are unconstitutional or something to that extent.
You don't have the balls to declare DUIs unconstitutional?
I'm not saying that I don't. I'm just saying that the general rule of thumb is if you're going to go down that path, best that you consult with an elected first before making those kinds of really significant decisions.
Now, you don't have to name names, and you probably shouldn't, but as you know, as I know, as probably some of our listeners know, but maybe not, judges in this state are elected. They go through the political process, they campaign, they require the vote of the people to ascend or keep office. Pro tems don't. So, two questions. One, do you feel that judges, some judges, not all judges, and again, we don't have to name names, but do you think some judges are sensitive to that political situation and that the fact that they will have to run for re-election affects or influences or weighs on their mind when they're making decisions on cases?
I would say absolutely yes, that it weighs on their mind when making decisions, that the impacts of the decision that they make may affect their voting constituency, and like any other elected politician, you know, they have to keep their re-election prospects in mind. Although I think that particularly for the more experienced judges, there's also a general mindset that once you've been on the bench long enough, your status as an incumbent gives you a much, much broader latitude because there's just not a lot of competition out there for incumbent judges. There's not zero competition, and we've seen that recently in Seattle Municipal Court.
There's been an uptick, I think, in contested judicial elections.
And I think that you're going to see more of that as the political spectrum continues to get even more polarized. As far as appointments of pro tems, I don't think that that factors into the equation quite as much, but at the same time, I do think that you see a difference in the vetting process for smaller jurisdictions versus larger jurisdictions. And I have actually made inquiries about becoming a pro tem in the Seattle area in King County, and I can tell you that the process in this county and within the city of Seattle is much, much different.
Can you appear in those courts that you pro temed in?
Not as an attorney of record, no.
So if you did pro tem in King County, that would be a swath of courts that you will no longer be able to appear in.
It would be giving up a significant portion of my practice in order to do that, absolutely. And that's a big risk because pro tem gigs are by no means regular. You don't get a set schedule. It's actually a lot like being a substitute teacher in that you never know when the call is going to come in. And you can't ever say you're guaranteed a certain minimum number of hours. And frankly, the pay is not enough to justify giving up your day job.
I've met a couple professional pro tems who that's all they do is just go around to courts around the state and fill in. And I think that you can make a living at it. I mean, it's like you say, a substitute teacher is not super reliable. You don't know where you'll be. But if that's what you want to do, I think it's not as interesting as being an advocate. But, you know, it's a nice change of pace. But you are not elected. You serve at the pleasure of an elected judge, but you yourself are not accountable to the voters. Do you think in some ways that liberates you to make an unpopular decision since you're kind of fly by night, come in, do your thing, come out?
You know, I don't really think much about the kind of impact that it's going to have on voters specifically. Whenever I make a decision on the bench, I think about what kind of precedent am I going to be setting, not only for the court that I'm in, but potentially for other courts around the state, because it does happen on rare occasion that a decision you make as a pro tem will become case law in some way, and it will affect other courts. Fortunately, I haven't really had any circumstances where I've had to make those kinds of statewide decisions, but I do keep that in the back of my head is, you know, if I'm going to make a decision one way or the other, I may not be accountable in the same way as an elected judge, but if I ever expect to hold that kind of position, that kind of responsibility, I need to keep that in firmly in my mind, and I need to give myself the kind of practice necessary to make those decisions while weighing those factors when I actually am accountable.
Now, you're not accountable to the voters. You can do what you want, but in some ways you're more accountable to your colleagues because you stand at equal level with other criminal defense attorneys. I mean, below me, but you know, generally equal level. And suddenly you might have a position where you have to make a ruling against a colleague and say, this person who paid you some money to represent them, you lose. I have made a decision. You've made a motion before me, and I'm ruling against you. And I'll see you at the bar next week, or I'll see you at this training next week. And does that ever weigh in your mind? I don't think it would affect you. I mean, we're all professionals, but do you ever think about the fact, hey, I know somebody, he's a colleague, and I've got to, you know, decide against him right now?
So I've had to rule on cases where I actually knew the attorney personally on maybe one or two brief occasions. Typically in those situations, I just make a really clear record of who the person is, what our relationship is, and I just ask very, very straightforwardly, does anybody have a problem with me making these decisions? And then once the decision is made, whether favorable or unfavorable to that person, I always make myself as available as I can to discuss the decision further at another point in time. But I do also keep in mind that as a pro tem judge, you are still bound to the rules of ethics that a normal judge would be, which means I do have to be really, really careful about those kinds of ex parte contacts when all is said and done. And having dealt with judges who were less, shall we say, stringent about those standards, I actually go out of my way to make sure that I never am in a situation where it might be construed as ex parte contact. But I also am not going to not have those conversations with people if there is an appropriate means in which to have those conversations.
You know, I used to be a public defender, and sometimes I would have clients, sometimes mental health issues, sometimes they've just been kind of stepped on by society, who would be concerned about the judges and the lawyers being in some kind of cahoots, you know, conspiracy. And it wasn't always that they were personally being targeted, just that this person didn't think they'd get a fair shake because there were these relationships. And I don't think that's true, but I also know, and I know the more I practice, the more true it is, it's a relatively small community of legal professionals. Judges mingle with attorneys all the time. There are trainings, there are networking events, and there are these relationships. And I think it's valid to say, I've known this person before, I'm going to probably see them again, I've met their kids. How do you think a defendant or a client should think about the separation between these personal relationships and their professional responsibilities?
That's a really tough question, because no matter what you do, that perception is going to be there. And that's unfortunate that we have a society where there is so much paranoia and there are so many conspiracy theories out there. And I've absolutely come across those types of mindset in every legal capacity that I've ever served in.
Well, you're saying paranoia and conspiracy theory, and certainly there are shades of that. But I also think you can tell when you go into a courtroom, the prosecutor and the judge can be friendly with each other, especially if they've been in front of each other for years. And for the person to say, these are not robots, these are actual people, and they have a friendly relationship with each other, that's a true thing. And being able to separate the concerns about a friendly relationship with the concerns about getting due process and a fair shake, I think is valid.
And I agree with that. And it's a tough line to draw. And as defense attorney, I think it's primarily your obligation to make that relationship known to your clients, to have that discussion with your clients, and to try and allay some of those fears. On the one hand, I do think that as attorneys, especially working in a criminal courtroom where personal liberty is at stake, you have a really clear responsibility to maintain that separation of personal and professional relationship in the courtroom. But at the same time, as you said, we're all people, and I'm not going to be the person who denies a prosecutor or a defense attorney from that personal relationship that they may have with either opposing counsel or with a judge. I'm not going to make that public in front of my client if that can be avoided. And certainly I'm not going to have those sort of water cooler conversations with one party or another if I'm on the bench and a defendant is sitting right there at the table. But at the same time, I think that you kind of have to show, especially the ones who have those misconceptions and those fears about sort of collusion between opposing counsel or between one party and the judge, I think you have to show them that humanity as well so that they understand that you're not a robot, that you're not somebody who's in the pocket of somebody else. And that is a very, very fine line to walk. I don't envy anybody who is in that position.
Do you think that our system, where judges, especially in contested elections, do go out, do debates, meet with constituents? Now, they're not like meet and greets like, you know, a senator or something, but they go out there. They have to be seen in public as part of their campaigning. Do you think that is good for our society? I mean, judicial elections in general is certainly a contested topic, but do you think it's better or worse for our system that judges are not sitting upon high and do walk among us and do interact with the people who they make rulings for and against?
Community outreach is incredibly important, and especially in the context of elections, elected judges comes with its own set of moral quandaries because, as you say, the judges actually have to go out there, put themselves out there, and have discussions with people who could very potentially be in front of them, either as a party to a case or as counsel. And,
you know, it's not just putting themselves out there. They solicit donations from people that will likely be appearing in front of them.
And that's an issue that we constantly struggle with, is how do you deal with the implicit bias that comes with people giving monetary contributions to a judge's political campaign. It's really, really difficult to separate those kinds of distinctions when you're talking about a judge. But at the same time, having that information out there is still more beneficial than just having a couple of names on a ballot with really no information about who they are or what they represent. My mother always used to tell me growing up that the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. And we have this...
Your mother believed in a lot of devils, apparently.
You know, she has a few stories about that, and those are stories for maybe another time. But the long and the short of it is that we have these almost unattainable ideals of what a judicial officer should be. We put these unnecessary pillars underneath our judges and expect them to be these entities of complete and total non-bias. We take away their humanity and expect them to operate like machines. And yet, every time we have a jury in a case, we explicitly instruct them that you do not leave your humanity at the door. You are still the sum of all of your life experiences. And the same is absolutely true for judges. The fact that some judges may have certain biases, I don't think should be an automatic disqualifier. I think if anything, it gives both attorneys and the parties that they represent a sort of baseline to understand who they're working with, what they're working with. And as a defense attorney working in a criminal context, if you go in front of a judge knowing that they have a particular bias, you still have mechanisms available to try and cure that. It's not always the path that you want to take, but we have those mechanisms for that reason.
I don't think that we are in a position or are able to get rid of biases. You know, judges are people, attorneys are people, jurors are people. We can say leave your biases at the door, and you know, to some extent they'll try, but humans being what they are, some people have good days, some people have bad days. Some particular issue might be an extra trigger for people, then you know, whatever. But it comes back to the basic question, which is should a judge try to become more, you said a robot, I think more, you know, autonomous or law-driven rather than humanity-driven? Is that a standard we should aspire to, even if it's probably impossible?
It's actually not the standard that I think judges should aspire to. Giving the impression of not having any bias is ultimately a good thing for instilling trust with the attorneys in a situation. Because obviously, if you're an advocate for somebody, you want to feel like you're making your arguments in front of somebody that has no preconceptions. But for the wider community that a judge impacts, for the individual defendants, for individual plaintiffs, showing that humanity, I think, is more important than showing just a bare neutrality. And in my personal experience in my personal law practice, the most positive experiences that I have gotten from my clients in front of judges are the judges who are willing to put their personal self out there on the bench and not just the robe. It's a very, very fine line to walk as a judge because obviously you still have to maintain those standards of discretion. But at the same time, I think pretending that you're anything other than a human being ultimately creates more harm than good.
So you're pro temming, and you're pro temming in Mason County and Thurston County, which is where Olympia is, and you don't live in those counties.
That's correct.
Thank, you know, whatever demon or whatever you want to believe in. Do you think it's better or worse for the people that appear before you that you're not a member of the community, that you did come in? Because, again, there's pluses and minuses, right? You're not elected. You're not accountable, which, again, has pluses and minuses to the people. But you don't necessarily know the culture. Since humanity is an important part of being a judge, you're not really tapped into that particular subsection of humanity where the judge normally works. Do you think that makes your job harder? Do you think you become more effective because of that?
Honestly, I do my best not to think about it too much, and that is something that the clerks really, really appreciate. And if anybody tells you otherwise, they're wrong. It's really the clerks who run any courtroom. The judge might be the one making the decisions, but the clerks really run the show. And you're absolutely right. Going into a smaller community like that definitely has its disadvantages because you don't know the people there, you don't know the culture there, and there are so many different social dynamics that vary from city to city, county to county, and the kind of dynamics we have here in the big city and in a larger county are vastly different than you would see in a place like Mason County or Thurston County, where the communities there are such that the judge probably knows a lot of the attorneys personally, probably knows a lot of the defendants personally. And I saw that in my practice as a prosecutor, I've seen it in my practice as a defense attorney, and I've absolutely seen it in my practice as a judge. However, the flip side of that coin is going in without those inherent biases or without that knowledge also puts you in a stronger position to make decisions that are ultimately better for that community. And that's been a big part of my experience in Mason County is the attorney culture there gets so ingrained in these practices that are ultimately really, really inefficient and detrimental to the administration of justice. And to have somebody come in who can occasionally whip them into shape and say, look, you're doing this wrong. You need to do it this other way if you want to follow what the law actually says, or you want to actually uphold the constitutional rights of this individual. And the attorneys may not appreciate it that much. Often they can be really resentful. But I'll tell you, the clerks love it. Because usually when you come in and you say, I'm going to make this courtroom more efficient, that means that you're going to make their job more efficient. And that is ultimately going to make the process better for everyone.
So it sounds like, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like you think of yourself as kind of a savior of Mason County. And before you answer that, I will tell you that the last guest I had in the show also called herself a savior. So this seems to be a trend among lawyers, but I'll just take your silence as assent that you come in and kind of bestow your wisdom, you shed your grace on Mason County, and they're better for it. You know, they might not appreciate you in your time, but, you know, down the road, your teachings, your writings will kind of have an influence, not just in that small community, but all across the bigger community, the state, or maybe past that.
I don't consider myself a savior so much as a fire starter. And that's a trend that I have maintained ever since law school, and I'm proud to call myself such because, honestly, I'd rather be known as somebody who did something that either started a conversation or sparked that kind of institutional change than somebody who just went along with it and never did anything at all.
So I have some notes here about things you want to talk about. We covered David Greenspan. We talked about David Greenspan. I know, David, you want to talk about David. And I think we covered most of those. But you also had something about mandatory sentencing that was a pet peeve of yours. So tell us, just to kick it off, I have right, mandatory sentencing, right? That was an issue?
That's an issue.
Kick us off by telling us what are the instances where mandatory sentencing comes up?
Mandatory sentencing comes up a lot more frequently than people actually realize in Washington State. When you look at it from the misdemeanor side of things, there are only a couple of instances where sentences are really mandated, being DUI and driving with suspended license. There aren't too many other situations within misdemeanor practice where mandatory sentencing really comes into play.
But just give us a quick overview of the DUI and the DWS one, or driving while suspended, in the first degree. I know the answer, but tell us.
Yeah, so with a DUI, your first DUI, depending on what you blow or whether or not you refuse to blow, you have either 1 day or 2 day mandatory jail sentence, as well as a mandatory fine of either $350 or $500 plus other assessments. With each successive DUI, again, depending on what you blow and whether or not you refuse to cooperate or refuse to blow, that mandatory minimum jumps up significantly to 30 or 45 days plus additional EHM time, all the way up to 90 days mandatory jail time, and I believe either up to 120 days or 180 days of mandatory EHM with successive offenses. In driving with suspended license first degrees, your first offense, I believe there's no mandatory. Your second is a 10-day mandatory, and your third is a 180-day mandatory.
And yeah, that third one is brutal.
It's really brutal, and in more ways than people really realize. But that's just for misdemeanors. When you get into felony land, almost every felony that a person can be charged with is subject to some degree of mandatory sentencing. And some people might be listening to this and thinking, no, we have a sentencing grid, the Sentencing Reform Act of 1989.
There's no way anybody listening is going to say, we have a Sentencing Reform Act of 1989. There's zero chance of that.
All right, so, I'll take your word for it.
But you're right, we do have that law in place, that they do have sentencing guidelines for felonies based on how severe the offense is and how many prior offenses a person has.
And that's my point, is that because we have that grid, when you really look at it objectively, every single case, depending on where your client falls in that grid, there is a mandatory range that the judge must impose sentence within. And in most cases, that includes a minimum amount of incarceration. And the judge has almost no discretion to go above or below that range unless you make certain findings on the record. And frankly, most people don't have the time, the interest, or in many cases, the evidence to make those recommendations for exceptional sentences. So you end up with judges having less discretion over what sentence they can impose on any felony case. And this becomes a real serious problem. I actually just had a case very recently within the last 3 weeks where I had a defendant who was convicted after a trial of a what would be considered a very petty drug offense. But because of his history and because of the offense that he was charged with, the judge had no choice but to sentence him to 5 years in prison. 5 years for what amounted to about 2 rocks of crack cocaine and about $120 worth of cash. That, to me, just seems absurd. And the judge even expressed that it was a concern.
There seems to be a bit of a shift, I think, right now, culturally, that the federal mandatory minimum sentences, they're really extreme. And a lot of them was based on nonviolent drug offenses. And the Department of Justice is letting out a bunch of federal prisoners right now, and there's a lot of backlash against these mandatory minimum sentences in the federal courts. And I've heard that story before, that judges, federal judges have said, I don't think this is a fair sentence, but I have to follow the law, and this is what the law requires. But I think that is a valid point in the sense that the punishments are set by the legislature. They're not set by the judge. So why is a judge better suited to determine what the correct sentence is than the people who created the crime in the first place?
Because the judge is the one that has the actual the facts of the case before them at any given time. The legislative body that creates the laws may have anecdotes, may have stories from people who have been affected by certain behaviors, who may have a personal stake in wanting to make certain activities illegal. And that's understandable to a certain degree, but no legislative body ever sees an individual defendant. And until they've actually been in that place where you see the person, you hear their story, you hear the evidence against them, and you're able to take all of that into context, there's no way that a congressman will ever truly understand the impact that their legislative decision has on real lives. And judges, on the other hand, that's all that they ever see. And so they should have some discretion. I'm not saying that they should have complete discretion in every case. There really are some lines that need to be drawn. But to have no discretion, I think, is also wrong.
Well, the flip side is there's a range, right? There's a range of months a judge can give, a minimum, and then a maximum. And is there something to the argument that this range also keeps judges in line, that they don't send your guy to 20 years in prison because the range doesn't go that high?
What we often hear is we hear the stories of judges who make disproportional sentences because of any number of factors, usually, race or socioeconomic status, and they pose these insane sentences for crimes where the punishment really doesn't fit the crime itself. And that's all we ever hear about in the media. So people are really quick to scream, yes, we need to rein these judges in. We need to make sure that they don't abuse their discretion. But as in most cases where you have bad apples in the system, it's a really, really small minority of cases where that occurs. And because we have a system that allows for appeal practice, that allows for additional review, there are mechanisms in place to deal with those kinds of judges already. But when we pass these laws where we impose a mandatory range, we're effectively saying, even though you have been elected to this position where we trust you to make these life-changing decisions, we really don't trust you enough to make those decisions in a way that are appropriate. And to me, that speaks very poorly of our culture as a society that believes in the rule of law. And it also speaks really poorly to the amount of respect that we give, not just to elected officials, but specifically to judges who have to make those difficult decisions.
I don't disagree, not really. Is your proposal the ranges become zero to whatever the current maximum is as a change to the laws? That would be more in line with what you're thinking?
I think it really depends on the crime itself. I think when you are looking at violent crimes, particularly, violent crimes are in a totally different arena. And at a certain point, you have to be able to look at a person and say, you are a danger to yourself and others, and we can't let you be among the rest of society. There has to be a certain cooling off or reformation period for people who perpetuate violent crimes, sexual crimes. You know, there has to be that mandatory period where the system actually has an opportunity to try and bring them back to an acceptable kind of behavior standard. But for most other crimes, if you're talking about property crimes, if you're talking about drug crimes, if you're talking about crimes where the harm is not so significant to people, there really is no sense in having these mandated sentences because, in my opinion, prison, jail, incarceration really should only be used in those circumstances where it is absolutely necessary to keep the individual separated from society.
So here's the issue, I believe. I don't disagree that mandatory sentencing can lead to really disproportionately harsh sentences. But you have something like your guy who got, we'll say the mandatory minimum was 60 months. And if we gave the judges complete discretion, they could have somebody with the same crime and the same criminal history, but a different race, only get 30 months or get 90 months. And one of the reasons these ranges exist is that judges make sure their sentences are based on crime committed and past crimes committed and not by immutable characteristics like gender and race or orientation or that kind of thing. Because, going back to our topic before, judges are people and they have biases. And having that somewhat predictability regarding sentences where a judge's biases can't get in the way, either positively or negatively, doesn't strictly seem like a bad thing. I think that you're right that some crimes are too harsh, sentences are too harsh, and someone's history can really, really lead to some really harsh things. Our current point system doesn't differentiate between violent and nonviolent crimes.
Absolutely.
And that can definitely be a change. Nonviolent crimes could be worth half a point versus violent crimes. And there's a lot of changes, a lot of tinkering that can be done. But I do think we have to look at the flip side of a proposal that says judges can do whatever they want whenever they want it, which is some judges make bad decisions and that aren't bad in the sense that they're not good for society, not the society that we want and that our elected officials want.
You're absolutely right. I mean, there are going to be those outlier cases where judges are making bad decisions based on factors that they really shouldn't be considering. And there should be mechanisms in place to try to combat that in some way. But mandatory sentencing, I think, is not the appropriate mechanism for that. We have a very, very comprehensive appellate system in this state. And we also have a lot of really good judges out there who are making good decisions to take away the discretion from those good judges simply because we're worried about the possibility of bad judges, to me, I think is a wrong approach. And one other fact that I just want to point out really quickly, when you're talking about some of the most serious crimes out there, what a lot of people probably don't realize, and what I actually just learned fairly recently myself, is that Washington State does not have a parole system. There's a very common misconception that because we offer things like good time credits to people incarcerated in prison, that there is a sort of early release mechanism already in place, and that's partially true. But for people who are convicted of really serious crimes, things like robbery, even if there's no injury to a victim, even if it's a very, very small amount of property or money involved, even if there's no weapon involved necessarily, our three strikes law is such that it really doesn't matter what your personal circumstances are. You make that third mistake and you are done for life. And there is no mechanism in place to give even somebody who has the capacity to reform a chance to get out unless you go straight to the governor and ask for clemency. And to me, that speaks of a broken system as well.
You're right. We don't have a parole board. We have the Indeterminate Sentence Review Board, which is for sex crimes, and it's a whole other topic, and we're already into an hour. So I think you're right. I think there should be mechanisms to look at people who have been in prison for a while and shouldn't be in prison any longer. I totally agree with you. The response from the opponents is going to be, how do we pay for it? And the answer is, we pay for it through the money that we're giving to the prisons to house and feed these people. You know, there are ways to shift resources around. I think you're right. I think it's a huge project. I think it's very hard for elected officials to be considered soft on crime and continue to be elected. I think being tough on crime is a nice, catchy, pithy thing to say to get votes, and, you know, maybe that's a cultural shift. But I do think there is a shift happening. The war on drugs is becoming massively unpopular, and people are realizing that throwing people in prison for decades doesn't really make society safer or better. It just makes broken homes and, you know, lost opportunities. So I think there's a lot of room to move. I think there's a lot of work to be done still, and I do appreciate you raising the issues. We have hit an hour now. I am going to edit this down. The parts where you're really, really going off on tangents and name-dropping, I'm going to cut out. So it's probably going to be about a five-minute podcast or so.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate you coming in, David. It was great to talk to you and hear your thoughts and hear your experiences. You've had very different experiences than mine, and I appreciate that. And maybe we'll talk to you again sometime.
It's been a real pleasure.
I'm going to sign off. This is Noah Weil with David Greenspan. Thanks for listening.